what does the future hold for U.S.-China relations? When the Soviet Union fell, many thought China was poised to be the next evil empire. So is it? Ross Terrell is an expert on U.S.-China relations. He's just written a book called The New Chinese Empire and What It Means for the United States. Terrell says diplomacy between the People's Republic of China and the U.S. was greatly affected by the events of September 11th.
They improved them because President Bush has been scraping up allies in the war against terror wherever he can find them. And Beijing had a good reason to sign on. Their reason isn't exactly the same as ours. I think for most Americans, the war on terror is about defending freedom against the supreme unaccountability of a terrorist organization. For China, it's a question of the unity of China because they've got a lot of non-Chinese peoples in the western half of the country, and in particular, they've got Muslims in the West who have links outside of China, and the U.S. agreed to name some of the Muslims in exile from Xinjiang, this western part of China, as a terrorist organization, which arguably they are. I mean, some of the Uyghurs, as they're called, use violent methods, others don't. So there we are. We have an FBI office in Beijing today, and the fact that to some extent we're at cross purposes, well, we're at cross purposes with Pakistan too. I mean, any dictatorship is arguably a poor candidate for the war on terror, but there it is. We're not in a perfect world.
But it is true, isn't it, that we're ignoring the lack of democracy in China at the same time that we're extolling the virtues of democracy everywhere else in the world?
Well, you're absolutely right. Most Americans go to the China coast. But China, the PRC, is really a rough equivalent to the whole of Europe, both in size, in diversity of culture, and even of language. It has borders with 14 countries, leaving aside some additional ones where the foreign country is just a couple of hundred miles across the water. It abuts Southeast Asia, Northeast Asia, Central Asia, and South Asia, a very unenviable environment. We have no idea what it's like to govern China because we've got a huge ocean east and west, and we've got a benign neighbor in the north and a benign neighbor in the south. It's quite different in China, and China's not had any other traditional way of holding the place together except autocracy. And it's my argument in the book that partly for inherent reasons of governance, partly because the Communist Party skillfully grafted Leninism onto elements of an imperial tradition, that it remains an autocratic show. And yes, we exempt China from our clarion calls for democracy.
How should we view this enormous country? I mean, is it possible? We tend to talk of China as though it were one thing, and the China you've just described is only superficially one thing. It's a country that includes 100 different peoples and an awful lot of ideas that are boiling under the control of the state.
China is a bit of a dinosaur. To still have a Leninist system, or what I call an imperial system, a system from above where the state is the fount of truth as well as of power, and where the non-Chinese peoples are not called by hyphenated titles. You can't be a Korean Chinese or a Tibetan Chinese in China. You are part of the Korean national minority or the Tibetan national minority. What does that mean? You're a building block. You're part of a collective building block in an imperium.
But at the same time, if you are a part of the collective building block, if you are a collective building block, then you are, by definition, not fully Chinese and therefore perhaps not as good as the Chinese themselves?
Well, the Tibetans think that, but the Chinese position is that everyone is destined to be a citizen of China. And in practice, this means that a Han-led political culture is emerging. I've got a section in the book where I discuss various scenarios for how Beijing will relate to the peripheral areas. One of them is that they'll pull it off. They will homogenize Inner Mongolia and the rest by sending so many Han people there and having sufficient economic success that people will wake up 30 years from now and say, well, I'm not really just a Mongolian, I'm part Chinese, and the problem will be solved. That's Beijing's hope. Other possibility is that economic development will actually add to the sense of identity of the Uyghurs, the Muslims in Xinjiang, the Tibetans, and that they will be less accommodating to Beijing's straitjacket of Chineseness when they prosper than they were before.
How much can we look to the experience of the fall of the Soviet Union in trying to anticipate the future for the Chinese empire?
The Chinese Communist Party is not as much a failure as the Communist Party of the Soviet Union was by the mid-80s. The Communist Party of China has made a tacit pact with the people. You get rich and you let us run the place with an iron hand. And if economic growth continues, that pact may continue. The second big difference with the Soviet Union is that the Soviet Union was only half Russian. The rest were other ethnicities. China's 90% Han. And though the non-Han, the non-Chinese, occupy a large amount of Western and Northern territory, that is a big difference to the potentiality for uprising. The Soviet Union came apart when Gorbachev loosened at the center, and then the non-Russian peoples, the Estonians, the Latvians, the Ukrainians, took advantage of the situation, and suddenly the Soviet Union looked like an empire. Well, it had always been an empire. But if that happens in the Chinese case, there's far smaller percentage of people who are non-Chinese who'll be standing up and saying, we want to be a separate nation.
There's also the question that you raise of the economic future of China, because at the moment it's in a state of transition. It's been a communist-controlled state and remains that. But there is a transition to a capitalist economic system. Is it possible for those two to coexist? Is there a future, a solid future for China with those two working together or in conflict?
I don't believe so. I think to travel down one road in economics, commercialization, or arguably, as you say, capitalism, and another road in politics, a system from above where no one's elected, doesn't make for a clear destination or a very comfortable journey. Now, there are two views here. The Communist Party thinks that they're streamlining the system by becoming prosperous. They think the commercialization of China will not interfere with the ongoing authoritarianism of the system. What do I mean by authoritarianism? It's a one-party state where the Communist Party has a guaranteed monopoly of political power and no one elects its leaders. This is pretty rare now among the major countries, but we still have it in China. The other view, Jim, is that what happens in society and the economy will ultimately produce a new politics, that you can't separate economic freedom and political freedom indefinitely.
In the light of Chinese history, and Chinese history goes back for thousands of years, is the new Chinese empire that you talk about now significantly different?
China as a civilization is indubitably great, but they have had a lot of trouble with the political system. And sometimes their solution to this is just smoke and mirrors. You have a you have a gap between theory and practice. For example, in the dynastic period, the emperor was called the Son of Heaven. His realm was called All Under Heaven. So in theory, there was no differentiation between Chinese civilization and world civilization. There were no boundaries. Now, in fact, reality was different. But this rather delightful conceit, it sustained the Chinese. So this gap between theory and practice has served the Chinese very well. And now, of course, the gap is updated. This is supposed to be a Marxist-Leninist state, but as you said, it's shed many of the aspects of a Marxist-Leninist economy, and it allows people to be non-socialist as long as they're not anti-socialist. There's no connection here between the public philosophy of China and this new individualism. It's if the people on a different planet. The individuals in the cities are not so much against the Communist Party, they just think the Communist Party is somewhat irrelevant.
Ross Terrell is the author of the book The New Chinese Empire and What It Means for the United States.